Chapter 8. The surrender was a bitter pill to swallow, but Marechal Pétain was an honorable man, a hero of the last war with Germany. Yes, he was old, but Vianne shared the belief that this only gave him a better perspective from which to judge their circumstances. He had fashioned a way for their men to come home, so it wouldn't be like the Great War. Vianne understood what Isabel could not. Pétain had surrendered on behalf of France to save lives and preserve their nation and their way of life. It was true that the terms of this surrender were difficult. France had been divided into two zones, the occupied zone, the north half of the country and the coastal regions, including Carrevaux, was to be taken over and governed by the Nazis. The great middle of the country, the land that lay below Paris and above the sea, would be the free zone, governed by a new French government in Vichy, led by Marechal Pétain himself, in collaboration with the Nazis. Immediately upon France's surrender, food became scarce. Laundry soap, unobtainable. Ration cards could not be counted upon. Phone service became unreliable, as did the mail. The Nazis effectively cut off communication between cities and towns. The only mail allowed was on official German postcards. But for Vianne, these were not the worst of the changes. Isabel became impossible to live with. Several times since the surrender, while Vianne toiled to reconstruct and replant her garden and repair her damaged fruit trees, she had paused in her work and seen Isabel standing at the back gate, staring up at the sky, as if some dark and horrible thing were headed this way. All Isabel could talk about was the monstrosity of the Nazis and their determination to kill the French. She had no ability, of course, to hold her tongue, and since Vianne refused to listen, Sophie became her sister's audience, her acolyte. Isabel filled poor Sophie's head with terrible images of what would happen, so much so that the child had nightmares. Vianne dared not leave the two of them alone, and so today, like each of the previous days, she made them both come to town with her to see what their ration cards would get them. They had been standing in a food queue at the butcher's shop for 2 hours already. Isabel had been complaining nearly that whole time. Apparently, it made no sense to her that she should have to shop for food. "Vianne, look," Isabel said. More dramatics. "Vianne, look." She turned, just to silence her sister, and saw them. Germans. Up and down the street, windows and doors slammed shut. People disappeared so quickly, Vianne found herself suddenly standing alone on the sidewalk with her sister and daughter. She grabbed Sophie and pulled her against the butcher shop's closed door. Isabel stepped defiantly into the street.
"Isabel!"
Vianne hissed. But Isabel stood her ground, her green eyes bright with hatred, her pale, fine-boned, beautiful face marred by scratches and bruises. The green lorry in the lead came to a halt in front of Isabel. In the back, soldiers sat on benches, facing one another, rifles laid casually across their laps. They looked young and clean-shaven and eager in brand-new helmets with medals glinting on their gray-green uniforms. Young, most of all. Not monsters, just boys, really. They craned their necks to see what had stopped traffic. At the sight of Isabel standing there, the soldiers started to smile and wave. Vianne grabbed Isabel's hand and yanked her out of the way. The military entourage rumbled past them, a string of vehicles and motorcycles and lorries covered in camouflaged netting. Armored tanks rolled thunderously on the cobblestone street. And then came the soldiers. Two long lines of them, marching into town. Isabel walked boldly alongside them up Rue Victor Hugo. The Germans waved to her, looking more like tourists than conquerors.
"Maman, you can't let her go off by herself," Sophie said.
"Merde!"
Vianne clutched Sophie's hand and ran after Isabel. They caught up with her in the next block. The town square, usually full of people, had practically emptied. Only a few townspeople dared to remain as the German vehicles pulled up in front of the town hall and parked. An officer appeared. Or Vianne assumed he was an officer because of the way he began barking orders. Soldiers marched around the large cobblestone square, claiming it with their overwhelming presence. They ripped down the flag of France and replaced it with their Nazi flag, a huge black swastika against a red and black background. When it was in place, the troops stopped as one, extended their right arms, and yelled,
"Heil Hitler!"
"If I had a gun," Isabel said, "I'd show them not all of us wanted to surrender."
"Shh," Vianne said. "You'll get us all killed with that mouth of yours. Let's go."
"No, I want..."
Vianne spun to face Isabel.
"Enough. You will not draw attention to us. Is that understood?"
Isabel gave one last hate-filled glance at the marching soldiers and then let Vianne lead her away. They slipped from the main street and entered a dark cleft in the walls that led to a back alley behind the milliner's shop. They could hear the soldiers singing. Then a shot rang out, and another. Someone screamed. Isabel stopped.
"Don't you dare," Vianne said. "Move."
They kept to the dark alleys, ducking into doorways when they heard voices coming their way. It took longer than usual to get through town, but eventually they made it to the dirt road. They walked silently past the cemetery and all the way home. Once inside, Vianne slammed the door behind her and locked it.
"You see?"
Isabel said instantly. She had obviously been waiting to throw out the question.
"Go to your room,"
Vianne said to Sophie. Whatever Isabel was going to say, she didn't want Sophie to hear. Vianne eased the hat from her head and set down her empty basket. Her hands were shaking.
"They're here because of the airfield,"
Isabel said. She began pacing.
"I didn't think it would happen so fast, even with the surrender. I didn't believe. I thought our soldiers would fight anyway. I thought..."
"Quit biting your nails. You'll make them bleed, you know."
Isabel looked like a madwoman, with her waist-length blonde hair falling loose from its braid and her bruised face twisted with fury.
"The Nazis are here, Vianne, in Carivaux. Their flag flies from the Hôtel de Ville as it flies from the Arc de Triomphe and the Eiffel Tower. They weren't in town 5 minutes and a shot was fired."
"The war is over, Isabel. Maréchal Pétain said so."
"The war is over? The war is over? Did you see them back there, with their guns and their flags and their arrogance? We need to get out of here, V. We'll take Sophie and leave Carivaux."
"And go where?"
"Anywhere. Lyon, maybe. Provence. What was that town in the Dordogne where Maman was born? Brantôme. We could find her friend, that Basque woman. What was her name? She might help us."
"You're giving me a headache."
"A headache is the least of your problems," Isabel said, pacing again.
Vianne approached her.
"You are not going to do anything crazy or stupid. Am I understood?"
Isabel growled in frustration and marched upstairs, slamming the door behind her. Surrender. The word stuck in Isabel's thoughts. That night, as she lay in the downstairs guest bedroom, staring up at the ceiling, she felt frustration lodge in her so deeply she could hardly think straight. Was she supposed to spend the war in this house like some helpless girl, doing laundry and standing in food lines and sweeping the floor? Was she to stand by and watch the enemy take everything from France? She had always felt lonely and frustrated, or at least she had felt it for as long as she could remember, but never as sharply as now. She was stuck here in the country with no friends and nothing to do. No. There must be something she could do. Even here, even now. Hide the valuables. It was all that came to her. The Germans would loot the houses in town. Of that she had no doubt, and when they did, they would take everything of value. Her own government, cowards that they were, had known that. It was why they had emptied much of the Louvre and put fake paintings on the museum walls.
"Not much of a plan," she muttered, "but it was better than nothing."
The next day, as soon as Vianne and Sophie left for school, Isabel began. She ignored Vianne's request that she go to town for food. She couldn't stand to see the Nazis, and one day without meat would hardly matter. Instead, she searched the house, opening closets and rummaging through drawers and looking under the beds. She took every item of value and set it on the trestle table in the dining room. There were lots of valuable heirlooms: lacework tatted by her great-grandmother, a set of sterling silver salt and pepper shakers, a gilt-edged Limoges platter that had been their aunt's, several small impressionist paintings, a tablecloth made of fine ivory Alençon lace, several photograph albums, a silver-framed photograph of Vianne and Antoine and baby Sophie, her mother's pearls, Vianne's wedding dress, and more. Isabel boxed up everything that would fit in a wooden-trimmed leather trunk, which she dragged through the trampled grass, wincing every time it scraped on a stone or thudded into something. By the time she reached the barn, she was breathing hard and sweating. The barn was smaller than she remembered. The hayloft, once the only place in the world where she was happy, was really just a small tier on the second floor, a bit of floor perched at the top of a rickety ladder and beneath the roof, through which slats of sky could be seen. How many hours had she spent up here alone with her picture books, pretending that someone cared enough to come looking for her? Waiting for her sister, who was always out with Rachel or Antoine. She pushed that memory aside. The center of the barn was no more than 30 feet wide. It had been built by her great-grandfather to hold buggies back when the family had money. Now there was only an old Renault parked in the center. The stalls were filled with tractor parts and web-draped wooden ladders and rusted farm implements. She closed the barn door and went to the automobile. The driver's side door opened with a squeaking, clattering reluctance. She climbed in, started the engine, drove forward about 8 feet, and then parked. The trap door was revealed now, about 5 feet long and 4 feet wide, and made of planks connected by leather straps. The cellar door was nearly impossible to see, especially as it was now, covered in dust and old hay. She pulled the trap door open, letting it rest against the automobile's dinged-up bumper, and peered down into the musty darkness. Holding the trunk by its strap, she turned on her torchlight and clamped it under her other armpit and climbed down the ladder slowly, clanking the trunk down, rung by rung, until she was at the bottom. The trunk clattered onto the dirt floor beside her. Like the loft, this hidey hole had seemed bigger to her as a child. It was about 8 feet wide and 10 feet long, with shelving along one side and an old mattress on the floor. The shelves used to hold barrels for winemaking, but a lantern was the only thing left on the shelves. She tucked the trunk into the back corner and then went back to the house, where she gathered up some preserved food, blankets, some medical supplies, her father's hunting shotgun, and a bottle of wine, all of which she put out on the shelves. When she climbed back up the ladder, she found Vianne in the barn.
"What in the world are you doing out here?"
Isabel wiped her dusty hands on the worn cotton of her skirt.
"Hiding your valuables and putting supplies down here, in case we need to hide from the Nazis. Come down and look. I did a good job, I think."
She backed down the ladder, and Vianne followed her into the darkness. Lighting a lantern, Isabel proudly showed off Papa's shotgun and the foodstuffs and medical supplies. Vianne went straight to their mother's jewelry box, opening it. Inside lay brooches and earrings and necklaces, mostly costume pieces. But at the bottom, lying on blue velvet, were the pearls that grand-mère had worn on her wedding day and given to Maman to wear on her wedding day.
"You may need to sell them someday,"
Isabel said. Vianne clamped the box shut.
They are heirlooms, Isabel. For Sophie's wedding day and yours, I would never sell them.
She sighed impatiently and turned to Isabel.
What food were you able to get in town?
I did this instead.
Of course you did. It's more important to hide Maman's pearls than to feed your niece supper. Honestly, Isabel.
Vianne climbed up the ladder, her displeasure revealed in tiny, disgusted huffs. Isabel left the cellar and drove the Renault back into place over the door. Then she hid the keys behind a broken board in one of the stalls. At the last moment, she disabled the automobile by removing the distributor cap. She hid it with the keys. When she finally returned to the house, Vianne was in the kitchen frying potatoes in a cast-iron skillet.
I hope you aren't hungry.
I'm not.
She moved past Vianne, barely making eye contact.
Oh, and I hid the keys and distributor cap in the first stall, behind a broken board.
In the living room, she turned on the radio and scooted close, hoping for news from the BBC. There was a staticky crackle, and then an unfamiliar voice said,
This is the BBC. General de Gaulle is speaking to you.
Vianne!
Isabel yelled toward the kitchen.
Who is General de Gaulle?
Vianne came into the living room, drying her hands on her apron.
What is...
Shh!
Isabel snapped.
The leaders who have been at the head of the French army for many years have formed a government. On the pretext that our army has been defeated, this government has approached the enemy with a view to ceasing hostilities.
Isabel stared at the small wooden radio, transfixed. This man they'd never heard of spoke directly to the people of France, not at them as Pétain had done, but to them in an impassioned voice.
Pretext of defeat! I knew it!
We certainly have been and still are submerged by the mechanical strength of the enemy, both on land and in the air. The tanks, the aeroplanes, the tactics of the Germans astounded our generals to such an extent that they have been brought to the pain which they are in today. But has the last word been said? Has all hope disappeared? Is the defeat final?
Mon Dieu!
Isabel said. This was what she'd been waiting to hear. There was something to be done, a fight to engage in. The surrender wasn't final.
Whatever happens, de Gaulle's voice went on, the flame of French resistance must not and shall not die.
Isabel hardly noticed that she was crying. The French hadn't given up. Now all Isabel had to do was figure out how to answer this call. 2 days after the Nazis occupied Carrevaux, they called a meeting for the late afternoon. Everyone was to attend, no exceptions. Even so, Vianne had had to fight with Isabel to get her to come. As usual, Isabel did not think ordinary rules pertained to her, and she wanted to use defiance to show her displeasure. As if the Nazis cared what one impetuous 18-year-old girl thought of their occupation of her country.
Wait here,
Vianne said impatiently when she'd finally gotten Isabel and Sophie out of the house. She gently closed the broken gate behind them. It gave a little click of closure. Moments later, Rachel appeared on the road, coming toward them with the baby in her arms and Sarah at her side.
That's my best friend Sarah,
Sophie said, gazing up at Isabel.
Isabel,
Rachel said with a smile,
it's good to see you again.
Is it?
Isabel said. Rachel moved closer to Isabel.
That was a long time ago,
Rachel said gently.
We were young and stupid and selfish. I'm sorry we treated you badly, ignored you. That must have been very painful.
Isabel's mouth opened. Closed. For once, she had nothing to say.
Let's go,
Vianne said, irritated that Rachel had said to Isabel what Vianne had not been able to.
We shouldn't be late.
Even this late in the day, the weather was unseasonably warm, and in no time Vianne felt herself beginning to sweat. In town, they joined the grumbling crowd that filled the narrow cobblestone street from storefront to storefront. The shops were closed, and the windows were shuttered, even though the heat would be unbearable when they got home. Most of the display cases were empty, which was hardly surprising. The Germans ate so much. Even worse, they left food on their plates in the cafes. Careless and cruel it was, with so many mothers beginning to count the jars in their cellars so that they could dole out every precious bite to their children. Nazi propaganda was everywhere, on windows and shop walls, posters that showed smiling German soldiers surrounded by French children, with captions designed to encourage the French to accept their conquerors and become good citizens of the Reich. As the crowd approached the town hall, the grumbling stopped. Up close, it felt even worse. This following of instructions, walking blindly into a place with guarded doors and locked windows. "We shouldn't go in," Isabel said. Rachel, who stood between the sisters, towering over both of them, made a tisking sound. She resettled the baby in her arms, patting his back in a comforting rhythm.
"We have been summoned."
"All the more reason to hide," Isabel said.
"Sophie and I are going in," Vianne said,
although she had to admit that she felt a prickly sense of foreboding.
"I have a bad feeling about it," Isabel muttered.
Like a thousand-legged centipede, the crowd moved forward into the great hall. Tapestries had once hung from these walls, leftover treasures from the time of kings, when the Loire Valley had been the royal hunting ground. But all that was gone now. Instead, there were swastikas and propagandist posters on the walls. "Trust in the Reich," and a huge painting of Hitler. Beneath the painting stood a man wearing a black field tunic decorated with medals and iron crosses, knee breeches, and spit-shined boots. A red swastika armband circled his right bicep. When the hall was full, the soldiers closed the oak doors, which creaked in protest. The officer at the front of the hall faced them, shot his right arm out, and said,
"Heil Hitler!"
The crowd murmured softly among themselves. What should they do?
"Heil Hitler," a few said grudgingly.
The room began to smell of sweat and leather polish and cigarette smoke.
"I am Sturmbannführer Weld of the Geheime Staatspolizei, the Gestapo,"
the man in the black uniform said in heavily accented French.
"I am here to carry out the terms of the armistice on behalf of the Fatherland and the Führer. It will be of little hardship on those of you who obey the rules."
He cleared his throat.
"The rules. All radios are to be turned into us at the town hall immediately, as are all guns, explosives, and ammunition. All operational vehicles will be impounded. All windows will be equipped with material for blackout, and you shall use it. A 9 p.m. curfew is instantly in effect. No light shall be on after dusk. We will control all food, whether grown or imported."
He paused, looked out over the mass of people standing in front of him.
"Not so bad, see? We will live together in harmony, yes? But know this. Any act of sabotage or espionage or resistance will be dealt with swiftly and without mercy. The punishment for such behavior is death by execution."
He pulled a pack of cigarettes from his breast pocket and extracted a single cigarette. Lighting it, he stared out at the people so intently it seemed he was memorizing each face.
"Also, although many of your ragged, cowardly soldiers are returning, we must inform you that the men taken prisoner by us shall remain in Germany."
Vianne felt confusion ripple through the audience. She looked at Rachel, whose square face was blotchy in places, a sign of anxiety.
"Mark and Antoine will come home," Rachel said stubbornly.
The Sturmbannführer went on.
"You may leave now, as I am sure we understand each other.
I will have officers here until 8:45 tonight. They will receive your contraband. Do not be late. And," he smiled good-naturedly, "do not risk your lives to keep a radio. Whatever you keep or hide, we will find, and if we find it, death."
He said it so casually, and wearing such a fine smile, that for a moment it didn't sink in. The crowd stood there a moment longer, uncertain whether it was safe to move. No one wanted to be seen as taking the first step. And then suddenly, they were moving, pack-like, toward the open doors that led them outside.
"Bastards," Isabel said as they moved into an alley. "And I was so sure they'd let us keep our guns,"
Rachel said, lighting up a cigarette, inhaling deeply and exhaling in a rush.
"I'm keeping our gun, I can tell you," Isabel said in a loud voice. "And our radio."
"Shh," Vian said. "General de Gaulle thinks..." "I don't want to hear that foolishness. We have to keep our heads down until our men come home," Vian said.
"Mon Dieu,"
Isabel said sharply.
"You think your husband can fix this?"
"No," Vian said. "I believe you will fix it, you and your General de Gaulle, of whom no one has ever heard. Now come. While you are hatching a plan to save France, I need to tend to my garden. Come on, Rachel, let us dullards be away."
Vian held tightly to Sophie's hand and walked briskly ahead. She did not bother to glance back to see if Isabel was following. She knew her sister was back there, hobbling forward on her damaged feet. Ordinarily, Vian would keep pace with her sister out of politeness, but just now she was too mad to care.
"Your sister may not be so wrong,"
Rachel said as they passed the Norman church on the edge of town.
"If you take her side in this, I may be forced to hurt you, Rachel."
"That being said, your sister may not be entirely wrong,"
Vian sighed.
"Don't tell her that. She's unbearable already."
"She will have to learn propriety."
"You teach her. She has proven singularly resistant to improving herself or listening to reason. She's been to 2 finishing schools and still can't hold her tongue or make polite conversation. 2 days ago, instead of going to town for meat, she hid the valuables and created a hiding place for us, just in case. I should probably hide mine, too. Not that we have much."
Vian pursed her lips. There was no point in talking further about this. Soon Antoine would be home, and he would help keep Isabel in line. At the gate to Le Jardin, Vian said goodbye to Rachel and her children, who kept walking.
"Why do we have to give them our radio, Maman?"
Sophie asked.
"It belongs to Papa."
"We don't," Isabel said, coming up beside them. "We will hide it." "We will not hide it," Vian said sharply. "We will do as we are told and keep quiet, and soon Antoine will be home, and he will know what to do." "Welcome to the Middle Ages, Sophie," Isabel said.
Vian yanked her gate open, forgetting a second too late that the refugees had broken it. The poor thing clattered on its single hinge. It took all of Vian's fortitude to act as if it hadn't happened. She marched up to the house, opened the door, and immediately turned on the kitchen light.
"Sophie," she said, unpinning her hat, "would you please set the table?"
Vian ignored her daughter's grumbling. It was to be expected. In only a few days, Isabel had taught her niece to challenge authority. Vian lit the stove and started cooking. When a creamy potato and lardon soup was simmering, she began to clean up. Of course, Isabel was nowhere around to help. Sighing, she filled the sink with water to wash dishes. She was so intent on her task that it took her a moment to notice that someone was knocking on the front door. Patting her hair, she walked into the living room, where she found Isabel rising from the divan, a book in her hands, reading while Vian cooked and cleaned, naturally.
"Are you expecting anyone?"
Isabel asked. Vian shook her head.
"Maybe we shouldn't answer," Isabel said. "Pretend we're not here."
"It's most likely Rachel,"
There was another knock at the door. Slowly, the doorknob turned, and the door creaked open. Yes, of course it was Rachel. Who else would? A German soldier stepped into her home.
Oh, my pardons,
the man said in terrible French. He removed his military hat, tucked it in his armpit, and smiled. He was a good-looking man, tall and broad-shouldered and narrow-hipped, with pale skin and light gray eyes. Vian guessed he was roughly her age. His field uniform was precisely pressed and looked brand new. An iron cross decorated his stand-up collar. Binoculars hung from a strap around his neck, and a chunky leather utility belt cinched his waist. Behind him, through the branches of the orchard, she saw his motorcycle parked on the side of the road. A sidecar was attached to it, mounted with machine guns.
Mademoiselle, he said to Vian, giving her a swift nod as he clicked his boots together.
Madame, she corrected him, wishing she sounded haughty and in control, but even to her own ears she sounded scared.
Madame Mauriac.
I am Hauptmann, Captain Wolfgang Beck.
He handed her a piece of paper and clicked his heels together again.
My French is not so good. You will excuse my ineptitude, please.
When he smiled, deep dimples formed in his cheeks. She took the paper and frowned down at it.
I don't read German.
What do you want? Isabel demanded, coming to stand by Vian.
Your home is most beautiful and very close to the airfield. I noticed it upon our arrival. How many bedrooms have you?
Why?
Isabel said at the same time Vian said,
three.
I will billet here,
the captain said in his bad French.
Billet?
Vian said.
You mean to stay?
Oui, madame.
Billet? You? A man? A Nazi? No. No.
Isabel shook her head. No. The captain's smile neither faded nor fell.
You were to town, he said, looking at Isabel. I saw you when we arrived.
You noticed me?
He smiled.
I am sure every red-blooded man in my regiment noticed you.
Funny you would mention blood,
Isabel said. Vian elbowed her sister.
I am sorry, Captain. My young sister is obstinate on occasion. But I am married, you see, and my husband is at the front, and there is my sister and my daughter here, so you must see how inappropriate it would be to have you here.
Ah, so you would rather leave the house to me. How difficult that must be for you.
Leave?
Vian said.
I believe you aren't understanding the captain,
Isabel said, not taking her gaze from him.
He's moving into your home, taking it over, really, and that piece of paper is a requisition order that makes it possible. And Pétain's armistice, of course. We can either make room for him or abandon a home that has been in our family for generations.
He looked uncomfortable.
This, I'm afraid, is the situation. Many of your fellow villagers are facing the same dilemma, I fear.
If we leave, will we get our home back?
Isabel asked.
I would not think so, madame.
Vian dared to take a step toward him. Perhaps she could reason with him.
My husband will be home any day now, I imagine. Perhaps you could wait until he is here?
I am not the general, alas. I am simply a captain in the Wehrmacht. I follow orders, madame. I do not give them. And I am ordered to billet here. But I assure you that I am a gentleman.
We will leave,
Isabel said.
Leave?
Vian said to her sister in disbelief.
This is my home.
To the captain, she said,
I can count on you to be a gentleman?
Of course.
Vian looked at Isabel, who shook her head slowly. Vian knew there was no real choice. She had to keep Sophie safe until Antoine came home, and then he would handle this unpleasantness. Surely he would be home soon, now that the armistice had been signed.
There is a small bedroom downstairs.
You'll be comfortable there.
The captain nodded.
Merci, madame. I will get my things.
As soon as the door closed behind the captain, Isabel said,
Are you mad? We can't live with a Nazi.
He said he's in the Wehrmacht. Is that the same thing?
I'm hardly interested in their chain of command. You haven't seen what they're willing to do to us, Vian. I have. We'll leave. Go next door, to Rachel's. We could live with her.
Rachel's house is too small for all of us, and I am not going to abandon my home to the Germans.
To that, Isabel had no answer. Vian felt anxiety turn to an itch along her throat. An old nervous habit returned.
You go if you must, but I'm waiting for Antoine. We have surrendered, so he'll be home soon.
Vian, please.
The front door rattled hard. Another knock. Vian walked dully forward. With a shaking hand, she reached for the knob and opened the door. Captain Beck stood there, holding his military hat in one hand and a small leather valise in the other. He said,
Hello again, madame,
as if he'd been gone for some time. Vian scratched at her neck, feeling acutely vulnerable beneath this man's gaze. She backed away quickly, saying,
This way, Herr Captain.
As she turned, she saw the living room that had been decorated by three generations of her family's women. Golden stucco walls, the color of freshly baked brioche, gray stone floors covered by ancient Aubusson rugs, heavily carved wooden furniture upholstered in mohair and tapestry fabric, lamps made of porcelain, curtains of gold and red toile, antiques and treasures left over from the years when the Rossignols had been wealthy tradesmen. Until recently, there had been artwork on the walls. Now only the unimportant pieces remained. Isabel had hidden the good ones. Vian walked past all of it to the small guest bedroom tucked beneath the stairs. At the closed door, to the left of the bathroom that had been added in the early 20s, she paused. She could hear him breathing behind her. She opened the door to reveal a narrow room with a large window, bracketed by blue-gray curtains that pooled on the wooden floor. A painted chest of drawers supported a blue pitcher and ewer. In the corner was an aged oak armoire with mirrored doors. By the double bed sat a nightstand. On it, an antique ormolu clock. Isabel's clothes lay everywhere, as if she were packing for an extended holiday. Vian picked them up quickly, and the valise, too. When she finished, she turned. His suitcase plunked to the floor. She looked at him, compelled by simple politeness to offer a tense smile.
You needn't worry, madame, he said gently. We have been admonished to act as gentlemen. My mother would demand the same, and in truth, she scares me more than my general.
It was such an ordinary remark that Vian was taken aback. She had no idea how to respond to this stranger who dressed like the enemy and looked like a young man she might have met at church. And what was the price for saying the wrong thing? He remained where he was, a respectful distance from her.
I apologize for any inconvenience, madame.
My husband will be home soon.
We all hope to be home soon.
Another unnerving comment. Vian nodded politely and left him alone in the room, closing the door behind her.
Tell me he's not staying, Isabel said, rushing at her.
He says he is,
Vian said tiredly, pushing back the hair from her eyes. She realized just now that she was trembling.
I know how you feel about these Nazis. Just make sure he doesn't know it. I won't let you put Sophie at risk with your childish rebellion.
Childish rebellion? Are you?
The guest room door opened, silencing Isabel. Captain Beck strode confidently toward them, smiling broadly. Then he saw the radio in the room and he paused.
Do not worry, ladies. I am most pleased to deliver your radio to the Commandant. Really? Isabel said. You consider this a kindness?
Vian felt a tightening in her chest. There was a storm brewing in Isabel. Her sister's cheeks had gone pale. Her lips were drawn in a thin, colorless line. Her eyes were narrowed. She was glaring at the German as if she could kill him with a look.
Of course.
He smiled, looking a little confused. The sudden silence seemed to unnerve him. Suddenly he said,
You have beautiful hair, mademoiselle.
At Isabel's frown, he said,
This is an appropriate compliment, yes?
Do you think so?
Isabel said, her voice low.
Quite lovely.
Beck smiled. Isabel walked into the kitchen and came back with a pair of boning shears. His smile faded.
Am I misunderstood?
Vian said.
Isabel, don't.
Just as Isabel gathered up her thick blonde hair and fisted it, staring grimly at Captain Beck's handsome face, she hacked off her hair and handed the long blonde tail to him.
It must be verboten for us to have anything beautiful, is it not, Captain Beck?
Vian gasped.
Please, sir, ignore her. Isabel is a silly, prideful girl.
No, Beck said. She is angry, and angry people make mistakes in war and die.
So do conquering soldiers, Isabel snapped.
Beck laughed at her. Isabel made a sound that was practically a snarl and pivoted on her heel. She marched up the stairs and slammed the door shut so hard the house shook.
You will want to speak to her now, I warrant, Beck said.
He looked at Vian in a way that made it seem as if they understood each other.
Such theatrics in the wrong place could be most dangerous.
Vian left him standing in her living room and went upstairs. She found Isabel sitting on Sophie's bed, so angry she was shaking. Scratches marred her cheeks and throat, a reminder of what she'd seen and survived, and now her hair was hacked off, the ends uneven. Vian tossed Isabel's belongings onto the unmade bed and closed the door behind her.
What in the name of all that's holy were you thinking? I could kill him in his sleep, just slit his throat. And do you think they would not come looking for a captain who had orders to billet here? Mon Dieu, Isabel.
She took a deep breath to calm her racing nerves.
I know there are problems between us, Isabel. I know I treated you badly as a child. I was too young and scared to help you, and Papa treated you worse. But this is not about us now, and you can't be the girl who acts impetuously anymore. It is about my daughter now, your niece. We must protect her. But France has surrendered, Isabel. Certainly this fact has not escaped you. Didn't you hear General de Gaulle? He said... And who is this General de Gaulle? Why should we listen to him? Maréchal Pétain is a war hero and our leader. We have to trust our government. Are you joking, Vian? The government in Vichy is collaborating with Hitler. How can you not understand this danger? Pétain is wrong. Does one follow a leader blindly?
Vian moved toward Isabel slowly, half afraid of her now.
You don't remember the last war, she said, clasping her hands to still them. I do. I remember the fathers and brothers and uncles who didn't come home. I remember hearing children in my class cry quietly when bad news came by telegram. And I remember the men who came home on crutches, their pant legs empty and flapping, or one arm gone, or a face ruined. I remember how Papa was before the war, and how different he was when he came home. How he drank and slammed doors and screamed at us, and then when he stopped. I remember the stories about Verdun and Somme and a million Frenchmen dying in trenches that ran red with blood. And the German atrocities, don't forget that part of it. They were cruel, Isabel.
That's my point exactly. We must... They were cruel because we were at war with them, Isabel. Pétain has saved us from going through that again.
He has kept us safe. He has stopped the war. Now Antoine and all our men will come home.
To a Heil Hitler world?
Isabel said with a sneer.
The flame of French resistance must not and shall not die. That's what de Gaulle said. We have to fight however we can, for France vie, so it stays France.
Enough, Vianne said.
She moved close enough that she could have whispered to Isabel or kissed her, but Vianne did neither. In a steady, even voice, she said,
You will take Sophie's room upstairs and she will move in with me. And remember this, Isabel. He could shoot us. Shoot us, and no one would care. You will not provoke this soldier in my home.
She saw the words hit home. Isabel stiffened.
I will try to hold my tongue.
Do more than try.
Chapter 9. Vianne closed the bedroom door and leaned against it, trying to calm her nerves. She could hear Isabel pacing in the room behind her, moving with an anger that made the floorboards tremble. How long did Vianne stand there alone, trembling, trying to get her nerves under control? It felt like hours passed while she struggled with her fear. In ordinary times, she would have found the strength to talk rationally with her sister, to say some of the things that had long been unspoken. Vianne would have told Isabel how sorry she was for the way she'd treated her as a little girl. Maybe she could have made Isabel understand. Vianne had been so helpless after Maman's death. When Papa had sent them away, to live in this small town, beneath the cold, stern eyes of a woman who had shown the girls no love, Vianne had wilted. In another time, she might have shared with Isabel what they had in common, how undone she'd been by Maman's death, how Papa's rejection had broken her heart, or how he'd treated her at 16 when she'd come to him pregnant and in love and been slapped across the face and called a disgrace, how Antoine had pushed Papa back hard and said, I'm going to marry her, and Papa's answer,
Fine, she's all yours. You can have the house, but you'll take her squalling sister, too.
Vianne closed her eyes. She hated to think about all of that. For years, she'd practically forgotten it. Now, how could she push it aside? She had done to Isabel exactly what their father had done to them. It was the greatest regret of Vianne's life. But this was not the time to repair that damage. Now she had to do everything in her power to keep Sophie safe until Antoine came home. Isabel would simply have to be made to understand that. With a sigh, she went downstairs to check on supper. In the kitchen, she found her potato soup simmering a bit too briskly, so she uncovered it and lowered the heat.
Madame, are you sanguine?
She flinched at the sound of his voice. When had he come in here? She took a deep breath and patted her hair. It was not the word he meant. Really, his French was terrible.
That smells delicious, he said, coming up behind her.
She set the wooden spoon down on the rest beside the stove.
May I see what you are making?
Of course, she said, both of them pretending her wishes mattered. It's just potato soup.
My wife, alas, is not much of a cook.
He was right beside her now, taking Antoine's place, a hungry man peering down at a cooking dinner.
You are married, she said, reassured by it, although she couldn't say why.
And a baby soon to be born. We are planning to call him Wilhelm, although I will not be there when he is born, and of course such decisions must inevitably be his mother's.
It was such a human thing to say. She found herself turning slightly to look at him. He was her height, almost exactly, and it unnerved her. Looking directly into his eyes made her feel vulnerable.
God willing, we will all be home soon, he said.
He wants this over too, she thought, with relief.
It's supper time, Herr Captain. Will you be joining us?
It would be an honor, madame. Although you will be pleased to hear that most evenings I will be working late and enjoying my supper with the officers. I shall also often be out on campaigns. You shall sometimes hardly notice my presence.
Vian left him in the kitchen and carried silverware into the dining room, where she almost ran into Isabel.
You shouldn't be alone with him,
Isabel hissed. The captain came into the room.
You cannot think I would accept your hospitality and then do harm. Consider this night. I have brought you wine, a lovely Sancerre.
You brought us wine,
Isabel said.
As any good guest would, he answered.
Vian thought, oh no. But there was nothing she could do to stop Isabel from speaking.
You know about Tours, Herr Captain, Isabel asked. How your Stukas fired on innocent women and children who were fleeing for their lives and dropped bombs on us?
Us?
He said, his expression turning thoughtful.
I was there. You see the marks on my face.
Ah, he said. That must have been most unpleasant.
Isabel went very still. The green of her eyes seemed to blaze against the red marks and bruises on her pale skin.
Unpleasant.
Think about Sophie,
Vian reminded her evenly. Isabel gritted her teeth and then turned it into a fake smile.
Here, Captain Beck, let me show you to your seat.
Vian took her first decent breath in at least an hour. Then, slowly, she headed into the kitchen to dish up supper. Vian served supper in silence. The atmosphere at the table was as heavy as coal soot settling on all of them. It frayed Vian's nerves to the breaking point. Outside, the sun began to set. Pink light filled the windows.
Would you care for wine, mademoiselle?
Beck said to Isabel, pouring himself a large glass of the Sancerre he had brought to the table.
If ordinary French families can't afford to drink it, Herr Captain, how can I enjoy it?
A sip, perhaps, would not be...
Isabel finished her soup and got to her feet.
Excuse me, I'm feeling sick to my stomach. Me too,
Sophie said. She got to her feet and followed her aunt out of the room like a puppy follows the lead dog, with her head down. Vian sat perfectly still, her soup spoon held above her bowl. They were leaving her alone with him. Her breathing was a flutter in her chest. She carefully set down her spoon and dabbed at her mouth with her serviette.
Forgive my sister, Herr Captain. She is impetuous and willful.
My oldest daughter is such a girl. We expect nothing but trouble when she gets a little older.
That surprised Vian so much that she turned. You have a daughter?
Gisela, he said, his mouth curving into a smile. She is 6, and already her mother is unable to get her to reliably do the simplest of tasks, like brush her teeth. Our Gisela would rather build a fort than read a book.
He sighed, smiling. It flustered her, knowing this about him. She tried to think of a response, but her nerves were too overwrought. She picked up her spoon and began eating again. The meal seemed to go on forever, in a silence that was her undoing. The moment he finished, saying,
"A lovely meal, my thanks,"
she got to her feet and began clearing the table. Thankfully, he didn't follow her into the kitchen. He remained in the dining room, at the table by himself, drinking the wine he'd brought, which she knew would have tasted of autumn, pears and apples. By the time she'd washed and dried the dishes and put them away, night had fallen. She left the house, stepping into the starlit front yard for a moment's peace. On the stone garden wall, a shadow moved. It was a cat, perhaps. Behind her, she heard a footfall. Then a match strike and the smell of sulfur. She took a quiet step backward, wanting to melt into the shadows. If she could move quietly enough, Perhaps she could return by the side door without alerting him to her presence. She stepped on a twig, heard it snap beneath her heel, and she froze. He stepped out from the orchard.
"Madame," he said, "so you love the starlight also? I am sorry to intrude upon you."
She was afraid to move. He closed the distance between them, taking up a place beside her as if he belonged there, looking out across her orchard.
"You would never know there is a war on out here," he said.
Vian thought he sounded sad, and it reminded her that they were alike in a way, both of them far away from the people they loved.
"Your superior, he said that all prisoners of war will remain in Germany. What does this mean? What of our soldiers? Surely you did not capture all of them?"
"I do not know, madame. Some will return, many will not."
"Well, isn't this a lovely little moment between new friends?" Isabel said, her voice as sharp as cut steel.
Vian flinched, horrified that she'd been caught standing out here with a German, the enemy, a man. Isabel stood in the moonlight, wearing a caramel-colored suit. She held her valise in one hand and Vian's best Deauville in the other.
"You have my hat," Vian said. "I may have to wait for a train. My face is still tender from the Nazi attack."
She was smiling at Beck as she said this. It wasn't really a smile. Beck inclined his head in a curt nod.
"You have sisterly things to discuss, obviously. I will take my leave."
With a brisk, polite nod, he returned to the house, closing the door behind him.
"I can't stay here," Isabel said.
"Of course you can.
I have no interest in making friends with the enemy, V."
"Damn it, Isabel. Don't you dare."
Isabel stepped closer.
"I'll put you and Sophie at risk, sooner or later. You know I will. You told me I needed to protect Sophie. This is the only way I can do it. I feel like I'll explode if I stay, V."
Vian's anger dissolved. Without it, she felt inexpressibly tired. This essential difference had always been between them. Vian, the rule follower, and Isabel, the rebel. Even in girlhood, in grief, they had expressed their emotions differently. Vian had gone silent after Maman's death, tried to pretend that Papa's abandonment didn't wound her, while Isabel had thrown tantrums and run away and demanded attention. Maman had sworn that one day they would be the best of friends. Never had this prediction seemed less likely. In this right now, Isabel was right. Vian would be constantly afraid of what her sister would say or do around the captain, and truthfully, Vian hadn't the strength for it.
"How will you go? And where?" "Train. To Paris. I'll telegram you when I arrive safely." "Be careful. Don't do anything foolish."
"Me? You know better than that."
Vian pulled Isabel into a fierce embrace and then let her go. The road to town was so dark, Isabel couldn't see her own feet. It was preternaturally quiet, suspenseful as a held breath, until she came to the airfield. There, she heard boots marching on hard-packed dirt, motorcycles and trucks rolling alongside the skein of barbed wire that now protected the ammunitions dump. A lorry appeared out of nowhere, its headlamps off, thundering up the road. She lurched out of its way, stumbling into the ditch. In town, it was no easier to navigate with the shops closed and the street lamps off and the windows blacked out. The silence was eerie and unnerving. Her footsteps seemed too loud. With every step, she was aware that a curfew was in effect and she was violating it. She ducked into one of the alleys, feeling her way along the rough sidewalk, her fingertips trailing along the storefronts for guidance. Whenever she heard voices, she froze, shrinking into the shadows until silence returned. It seemed to take forever to reach her destination, the train station on the edge of town.
"Halt!"
Isabel heard the word at the same time a floodlight sprayed white light over her. She was a shadow hunched beneath it. A German sentry approached her, his rifle held in his arms.
"You are just a girl," he said, drawing close. "You know about the curfew, yeah?" he demanded.
She rose slowly, facing him with a courage she didn't feel.
"I know we aren't allowed to be out this late. It's an emergency, though. I must go to Paris. My father is ill."
"Wer ist your Ausweis?"
"I don't have one."
He eased the rifle off his shoulder and into his hands.
"No travel without an Ausweis."
"But..."
"Go home, girl. Before you get hurt."
"But..."
"Now. Before I decide not to ignore you."
Inside, Isabel was screaming in frustration. It took considerable effort to walk away from the sentry without saying anything. On the way home, she didn't even keep to the shadows. She flaunted her disregard of the curfew, daring them to stop her again. A part of her wanted to get caught so she could let loose the string of invective screaming inside her head. This could not be her life. Trapped in a house with a Nazi in a town that had given up without a whimper of protest. Vianne was not alone in her desire to pretend that France had neither surrendered nor been conquered. In town, the shopkeepers and bistro owners smiled at the Germans and poured them champagne and sold them the best cuts of meat. The villagers, peasants mostly, shrugged and went on with life. Oh, they muttered disapprovingly and shook their heads and gave out wrong directions when asked. But beyond those small rebellions, there was nothing. No wonder the German soldiers were swollen with arrogance. They had taken over this town without a fight. Hell, they had done the same thing to all of France. But Isabel could never forget what she'd seen in the field near Tours. At home, when she was upstairs again, in the bedroom that had been hers as a child, she slammed the door shut behind her. A few moments later, she smelled cigarette smoke, and it made her so angry she wanted to scream. He was down there smoking a cigarette. Captain Beck, with his cut-stone face and fake smile, could toss them all out of this house at will. For any reason or no reason at all. Her frustration curdled into an anger that was like nothing she'd ever known. She felt as if her insides were a bomb that needed to go off. One wrong move or word, and she might explode. She marched over to Vianne's bedroom and opened the door.
"You need a pass to leave town," she said, her anger expanding. "The bastards won't let us take a train to see family."
From the darkness, Vianne said,
"So, that's that."
Isabel didn't know if it was relief or disappointment she heard in her sister's voice. "Tomorrow you will go to town for me. You will stand in the queues while I am at school and get what you can."
"But..."
"No buts, Isabel. You are here now and staying. It's time you pulled your weight. I need to be able to count on you."
For the next week, Isabel tried to be on her best behavior. But it was impossible with that man living under the same roof. Night after night, she didn't sleep. She lay in her bed, alone in the dark, imagining the worst. This morning, well before dawn, she gave up the pretense and got out of bed. She washed her face and dressed in a plain cotton day dress, wrapping a scarf around her butchered hair as she went downstairs. Vianne sat on the divan, knitting, an oil lamp lit beside her. In the ring of lamplight that separated her from the darkness, Vianne looked pale and sickly. She obviously hadn't slept much this week either. She looked up at Isabel in surprise.
"You're up early." "I have a long day of standing in lines ahead of me. Might as well get started," Isabel said. "The first in line gets the best food."
Vianne put her knitting aside and stood, smoothing her dress, another reminder that he was in the house. Neither of them came downstairs in nightdresses. She went into the kitchen and then returned with ration cards.
"It's meat today."
Isabel grabbed the ration cards from Vianne and left the house, plunging into the darkness of a blacked-out world. Dawn rose as she walked, illuminating a world within a world, one that looked like Carrevaux but felt entirely foreign. As she passed the airfield, a small green car with the letters P POL on the rear roared past her. Gestapo. The airfield was already a hive of activity. She saw four guards out front, two at the newly constructed gated entrance, and two at the building's double doors. Nazi flags snapped in the early morning breeze. Several aeroplanes stood ready for takeoff, to drop bombs on England and across Europe. Guards marched in front of red signs that read, "Verboten, keep out under penalty of death." She kept walking. There were already four women queued up in front of the butcher shop when she arrived. She took her place at the back of the line. That was when she saw a piece of chalk lying in the road, tucked in against the curb. She knew instantly how she could use it. She glanced around, but no one was looking at her. Why would they be, when there were German soldiers everywhere? Men in uniform strode through town like peacocks buying whatever caught their eye. Rambunctious and loud and quick to laugh. They were unfailingly polite, opening doors for women and tipping their hats, but Isabel wasn't fooled. She bent down and palmed the bit of chalk, hiding it in her pocket. It felt dangerous and wonderful just having it. She tapped her foot impatiently after that, waiting for her turn.
"Good morning," she said, offering her ration card to the butcher's wife, a tired-looking woman with thinning hair and even thinner lips.
"Ham hocks, £2, that's what is left."
"Bones?"
"The Germans take all the good meat, mademoiselle. You're lucky, in fact. Pork is verboten for the French, don't you know? But they don't want the hocks. Do you want them or not?"
"I'll take them," someone said behind her.
"So will I,"
yelled another woman.
"I'll take them," Isabel said.
She took the small packet, wrapped up in wrinkled paper and tied with twine. Across the street, she heard the sound of jackboots marching on cobblestone, the rattling of sabers in scabbards, the sound of male laughter, and the purring voices of the French women who warmed their beds. A trio of German soldiers sat at a bistro table not far away.
"Mademoiselle," one of them said, waving to her, "come have coffee with us."
She clutched her willow basket with its paper-wrapped treasures, small and insufficient as they were, and ignored the soldiers. She slipped around the corner and into an alley that was narrow and crooked, like all such passageways in town. Entrances were slim, and from the street, they appeared to be dead ends. Locals knew how to navigate them as easily as a boatman knows a boggy river. She walked forward, unobserved. The shops in the alley had all been shut down. A poster in the abandoned milliner's shop window showed a crooked old man with a huge hooked nose, looking greedy and evil, holding a bag of money and trailing blood and bodies behind him. She saw the word Juif, Jew, and stopped. She knew she should keep walking. It was just propaganda, after all, the enemy's heavy-handed attempt to blame the Jewish people for the ills of the world and this war. And yet, she glanced to her left. Not 50 feet away was Rue La Grande, a main street through town. To her right was an elbow bend in the alleyway. She reached into her pocket and pulled out her piece of chalk. When she was sure the coast was clear, she drew a huge V for victory on the poster, obliterating as much of the image as she could. Someone grabbed her wrist so hard she gasped. Her piece of chalk fell, clattered to the cobblestones, and rolled into one of the cracks.
"Mademoiselle,"
a man said, shoving her against the poster she'd just defaced, pressing her cheek into the paper so that she couldn't see him.
"Do you know it is verboten to do that? And punishable by death?